Do you remember, hadn't been very long, a story about Terry Thompson? Terry Thompson was a man from Zanesville, Ohio, who had a lot of exotic animals. He kept these in cages, and I think there were probably more than 50 in all. And many of these animals were quite dangerous. For some reason, he decided that he wanted to set them all free, and then he ended up killing himself. I mean, why would a man do that? These are powerful animals. These are dangerous animals. Why would you just let them go free? Well, some speculate that maybe he was angry because of financial difficulties that he found himself in, or maybe some other reasons. But still, why? Why would you? Does he not understand how dangerous these are? Well, it put the authorities in a difficult position. Because what can you do when these animals are set free? Well, unfortunately, if you saw the story, they had to kill the animals. Because you can't just let these animals go free. Someone's going to get hurt. Even Jack Hanna, who is an animal lover, justified their action, saying that these animals were too powerful to allow to go free. Do you know that you have something more powerful than a caged lion? Something more powerful than a 600-pound grizzly bear? Here in the book of James, in the third chapter, James says, we'll pick up the reading here in verse 5, "Even so the tongue is a little member and boasts great things. See how great a forest a little fire kindles. And the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. The tongue is so set among our members that it defiles the whole body and set on fire the course of nature and is set on fire by hell. For every kind of beast and bird of reptile and creature of the sea is tamed and has been tamed by mankind. But no man can tame the tongue. It is an unruly evil full of deadly poison." There was a sign on the highway there in Ohio saying, "Caution," telling the people, "You need to look out. There are dangerous animals on the loose, and these animals have the potential of great harm, of great danger." Well, we must recognize that we each have an extremely dangerous tongue. Maybe our tongue is like the lion who has the ability to devour with his mouth, to break even limbs. Maybe it's like the laughing hyena that might seem so innocent but also has a great deal of danger. Or it might be slender and slim like the poisonous snake. But in any case, this tongue that we have within our mouth that is caged naturally by our teeth, that God wants us to control, we must recognize is extremely, extremely dangerous. As a matter of fact, I would like for this to be our meditation verse of the week. This James chapter 3 and verse 8. And if you would, let's all say it together. "But no man can tame the tongue. It is an unruly evil full of deadly poison." Remember this by picking up a card on your way out and thinking about this and thinking about it as we go through the rest of these thoughts this morning. Here in James chapter 3, we pick up the reading in verse 10 where it says, "Out of the same mouth proceed blessing and cursing. My brethren, these things ought not to be so. Does a spring send forth fresh water and bitter from the same opening? Can a fig tree, my brethren, bear olives, or a grapevine bear figs? Thus, no spring can yield both salt water and fresh." We really have the potential in our tongues to be very constructive or be very destructive. But we have to determine how we're going to use that tongue. We have to determine how we are going to allow that tongue to affect those around us. So I would like for us in our lesson this morning to zero in on a few specific areas where we have great danger and we have great potential blessing to those that are around us. Is this tongue bitter water or is it fresh? Now you might be thinking that we're going to talk about gossip. We're going to talk about slander. We're talking about lying. Because those are ways that unfortunately the tongue is used much too often and with a great deal of danger. But I would like for us to focus on a few other areas that the tongue deals with in our lesson this morning. The cynical tongue or the encouraging tongue. First, the cynical tongue. Have you ever been around someone that always talks about the problem, always talks about the difficulties, always talks about what's going to go wrong, always talks about that there's going to be a failure? They say with their mouth, it'll never work. It never does work. She's never going to do right. He's never going to stay straight. She's never, always out of their mouth is something that's cynical, always finding the failure. And you know, that's easy for us to do because we are bombarded, are we not, with the negative. You turn on the news and what do you see? Do you see all of the kind people who are being generous to others and who are helping out their neighbors? Generally not. You see the murders, and you see the thefts, and you see the violence, and you see the destruction. All in the news, all of the time, all day, all through our lives. We are raising a generation of cynics. People who always see the negative, who always see what's wrong, who always knows right around the corner something is going to come that is going to spoil it. We see it in our politicians, right? Our politicians lie. Our school teachers abuse their kids. Our mothers kill their babies. Our preachers are hypocrites. And when people look out and they see their world and they hear this over and over and over and over again, it becomes something that they only can see, that they always focus on, the negative. In the Old Testament, I think we have an example of a cynic. In the book of 1 Kings, or at least a time in Elijah's life when he allowed his tongue to flap in a way that demonstrated very cynical ideas. You remember that he was a man who stood for God, and in chapter 18 of 1 Kings, he stood on Mount Carmel and showed that God was the true God, that God was the one to be listened to. And in fact, in verse 39, the people say, "The Lord, He is God. The Lord, He is God." People recognized that the Lord was God. But in the next chapter, in chapter 19 of 1 Kings, we find that Jezebel, a wicked woman who did not come to that contest, who did not confess that the Lord, He is God, she tries to kill Elijah. So Elijah flees. And notice a couple of things that he says in verse 4. He himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a broom tree, and he prayed that he might die, and said, "It is enough. Now, Lord, take my life, for I am no better than my father's." Notice what he also says in verse 10. "I have been very zealous for the Lord God of hosts, for the children of Israel have forsaken your covenant, torn down your altars, killed your prophets with the sword. I alone am left, and they seek to take my life. Woe is me. It's going to be destroyed. Everything's terrible. I am the only one that's left." Now, was it bad in Israel? Absolutely. Was this evil King Jezebel trying to kill him? Yes, she was. But it wasn't as bad as these words say. These are cynical words. He was not the only one. In chapter 19, in verse 18, God says, "Yet I have reserved 7,000 in Israel, all whose knees have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him." Yes, things were bad, but the cynic only focuses on the bad. Let me ask you a question. Are things worse today than they were just a generation ago? Are things worse today than they were in the first century during the time of Christ? Are things worse today than they were in the time of Elijah? I think immediately we would say, yes, yes, it's worse. I see it all of the time. I hear about this individual over in Decatur, and I hear about this person over in Ohio, and I hear about this lady over in California, and I hear about this disaster over in Japan, and I hear about this terrible thing happening over in China. You know, if we had lived a generation ago, we wouldn't know about any of those unless through the filtering system it somehow made it to our ears. We hear so much negative, so much evil, so many terrible things happening in the world because we turn on these news broadcasters, and that's their job to tell us the unusual, tell us the terrible, tell us the horrific. And it gives us an unrealistic picture of the way things really are. Yes, things are difficult. Yes, things are bad, but there are a lot of very good things that are happening in this world. There are a lot of very positive things. There are many, many blessings that are bestowed upon this world. The cynic has a false picture and paints a false picture with their tongue because all they say is negative. All they find is fault. In the book of 1 Samuel chapter 17, we find another example. David, this idealistic young man, comes to the fight that the Philistines were having, the Israelites were having with the Philistines, and there is this giant of a man, Goliath, who's standing and is challenging the people of Israel, the army of Israel, to come and to fight with him, and all of the army is afraid of him. I'm sure that they had seen many battles, they had seen many people die, they had seen many giant individuals crush those that were less skilled or smaller than he. And so they were rightly very afraid of that, even perhaps to the point of being cynical, to the point of, we are not going to go after this Goliath because he is going to kill us. Well, this idealistic man, young man, David, comes and he says, who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should stand in the presence of the army of God? I will go and I will fight this man, because he recognized the power of God. Well, in chapter 17 of 1 Samuel in verse 28, his older brother, Eliab, heard when he spoke to the men, and Eliab's anger was aroused against David. And he said, listen to how cynical this man, Eliab, is against the words of David. He says, "Why have you come down here? And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness?" He's belittling him already here. I mean, your job is to keep sheep. My job is to fight for the Lord. I have seen people die. I have seen these. You haven't seen anything out keeping a few sheep. Who are you to come here and say this? Very, very, very negative. He says, "I know your pride and the insolence of your heart, for you have come down to see the battle." What, was David a prideful young man? Was he an insolent man? Well, there may have been an occasion when he was a child, when he was growing up, that he acted in a proud way. But that's what the cynic does. There may be 10,000 great things that David had done, but that's not what the cynic sees. The cynic sees that one evil thing, that one bad thing, that one prideful thing, and he elevates that to the standard so that that's all he's able to see. Well, Eliab was wrong. David was not prideful. He was very humble. And because of that, he was able to have a great victory for the cause of God. the tongue of the cynic does not bring about good things, is not the proper use. It's a very dangerous way to use the tongue. Think about your words through the day. Listen to yourself. If you have to, write them down. What is it that you talk about? How is it that you use your tongue? If you find that you are a cynic, that all you ever see is the evil, you are not presenting reality, and you are using your tongue in a destructive way. What we can do instead is have an encouraging tongue. In the book of Acts, in the 4th chapter, we find a man who did just that. In fact, he is given a nickname in Acts chapter 4 and verse 36. This man, whose name is Joseph, who was also called Barnabas by the apostles, which is translated son of encouragement, a Levite of the country of Cyprus. This man, his name is Joseph, but we know him as Barnabas because that means son of exhortation, son of consolation, the man who learned to use his tongue in a way to encourage others. And notice a few instances. In Acts, the 9th chapter, you have a man who was a very bad man, Saul of Tarsus. He was a bad man because he was there when Stephen was stoned. He was a bad man because he was going to Damascus to capture those that were of the way and bring them back to trial. But this bad man became a Christian. And Barnabas knew about that, and Saul, he comes down to Jerusalem and wants to become a member of the church there in Jerusalem. They were afraid of him, but you have this man, Barnabas, using his tongue in a positive way. In verse 26 of Acts chapter 9, "And when Saul had come to Jerusalem and tried to join the disciples, but they were all afraid of him and did not believe that he was a disciple. But Barnabas took him and brought him to the apostles and declared," that's his use of a tongue, "to them how he had seen the Lord on the road, how he had spoken to him, how he had preached boldly at Damascus in the name of Jesus. So he was with them at Jerusalem, coming in and going out." Now, he didn't exaggerate. He did not lie. He did not tell something that was untrue. He simply told the facts, but he was a man who was willing to see the good facts even among the evil. And he used those good facts to show that, in fact, Saul had been converted to Jesus Christ. And because of that, the other brethren were willing to accept him. In chapter 15, we find this same man, Barnabas, son of exhortation, using his tongue in a positive way. In verse 36, after he and Paul had gone on his first journey, they were about to go on their second journey. It says, "Then after some days, Paul said to Barnabas, 'Let us now go back and visit our brethren in every city where we have preached the word of the Lord and see how they are doing.' Now Barnabas was determined to take with him John, called Mark, but Paul insisted that they should not take with them one who had departed from them in Pamphylia and had not gone with him to the work. Then a contention arose so sharp that they parted from one another, so that Barnabas took Mark and sailed to Cyprus, but Paul chose Silas and departed, being commended by the brethren to the grace of God." Here was a time when Barnabas used his tongue to stand up for this young man, John Mark. Now, I don't know what it was that he saw in his character, because John Mark did disappoint. They were going on the work, and he went home during the first journey. But he must have seen something good in him, and he used his tongue to speak concerning this young man. "Yes, we need to take him. Yes, I believe in him." You know, sometimes just somebody saying, "Yes, I believe in him, I believe in you, I believe in her," is going to be something that swells up, that's going to bring about good in their life. Barnabas did this. And you remember later that Paul in 2 Timothy chapter 4 commends John Mark and says he is useful to me in the work. Apparently, Barnabas was right. Again, take some stock in how you use your tongue. Is what comes out cynical always looking at the evil, always looking at the wrong, always seeing the negative, always seeing the disparity? Or do you have a tongue that also, realistically, sees what is good, sees what is positive, and encourages and uses that information to help individuals to be better? When you open your mouth, what comes out, bitter water or fresh? Because as the psalmist said, the words of the wise are like goads, and the words of the scholars are like well-driven nails given by one shepherd. The words of the wise, the words of the encourager, the words of Barnabas were goads. They encourage others to do better. Those words of the bitter are those that would squelch and hold down what is good in this world. A second way that we can use the tongue, either in a positive way or in a negative way, it can be used in a flattering or in a truthful way. Let's go to the book of Jude. The book of Jude, only one chapter, so we'll look at verse 16. When Jude is describing false teachers and the way they were misusing their tongue, actually in a variety of ways, but in this way in particular. Jude, verse 16, he says, "These are murmurers, complainers, walking according to their own lusts, and they mouth great swelling words, flattering people to gain advantage." It's almost exactly the opposite of the cynic, isn't it? The cynic is always looking to the negative and pronouncing the disaster, whereas the flatterer goes to the opposite ends and says only what is good, but not in a truthful way, not in an honest way, but says what is good so that they might be able to manipulate the hearer. They compliment, they exaggerate, they lie in order to try to gain some vantage. As he says there at the end of verse 16, flattering words to gain advantage. They are not saying what is good for the purpose of encouraging others to do better. They are saying what's good. In fact, they're willing to even lie and exaggerate what's good in order to find some approval for self. You know, there was a survey taken of the best pickup lines for women, or to be used on women. And the number one pickup line is, "How does it feel to be the most beautiful woman in the room?" Now, number one, I would advise you not to use pickup lines. Because what is a pickup line for? Is it to start an honest relationship? Is it to try to find someone that you can develop a friendship with, develop lines of communication with, develop a relationship with that might lead somewhere? No, a pickup line is used to try to get something out of someone. That's what flattery does. It's willing to exaggerate. Now, I'm not necessarily saying that you say, "How does it feel to be the," let's see, 6th most beautiful woman in the, that's probably not going to communicate what you want to get across to the woman either. But, and the fact is, it works both ways. We're kind of picking on the men here, but let's go back to the book of Proverbs in the 5th chapter of Proverbs. Solomon, who had, unfortunately, more experience with women than he should have had, says to his son in chapter 5 and verse 3, "For the lips of the immoral woman drip with honey, and her mouth is smoother than oil." He also, talking about the same woman here in chapter 7 and verse 21, "With her enticing speech she causes him to yield. With her flattering lips she seduces him. Immediately he went after her like an ox goes to the slaughter, or as a fool to the correction of the stocks, till an arrow struck his liver, as a bird hastens to the snare. He does not know what that it had taken his life." The woman as well as the man can use the words of flattery, but those words are going to be used to destruction. Because the fact is, People see behind. People see through the flattery. Now, there may be people who like to play games between men and women, and they accept that flattery from some man who's given a line, or they accept that flattery from some woman who's just trying to boost the ego, and they want to play that game because they're involved with the works of the flesh. But those who are honest, those who are decent, those that are individuals who are just in this world, are going to be able to see through that flattery. They're going to be able to see through the manipulation of those words, and it's actually going to be a destruction to your relationship. Last week in Hartsel on Monday night, I talked about hypocrisy. I preached that sermon a few months ago, or maybe it was a year or two ago here. I talked about hypocrisy. Well, one of the men, a member of the congregation there, who is involved with selling building materials, after talking about hypocrisy, and you know, hypocrisy and flattery are really first cousins of each other, because both of them talk about, or both of them use a front, both of them put up a mask in order to try to hide the true intentions. This young man came out afterward and kind of jokingly said, "You're killing my business. Do you mean I have to really be honest with my customer, those people I don't necessarily like all that much, but I'm trying to make a sale? Do I really have to be nice to them?" Well, we recognize that there's a difference between being a good salesman who's presenting the product in a way that is an honorable way so that their business can continue, and someone who uses flattery, someone who uses hypocrisy, someone who uses deceit in order. Think about the way that you use your tongue. Think about the way that you, as you go through the day, listen to yourself. Listen to the compliments that you are giving to others. Is it an honest, truthful compliment, or is it a compliment that perhaps is exaggerated, is flattery, in order to gain some approval from others? What we can do instead with our tongue is use it in a truthful, honest way. The Apostle Paul talks about this in 1 Thessalonians chapter 2. He had gone and preached the gospel to the people in Thessalonica, and apparently several of them became Christians. It wasn't long until the jealous Jews pushed them out of Thessalonica, and so he writes this letter back to Thessalonica and talks to the brethren through this letter. And he says, we'll pick up the reading here in chapter 2 and verse 3 of 1 Thessalonians. "For our exhortation did not come from deceit or uncleanness, nor was it in guile. But as we have been approved by God to be entrusted with the gospel, even so we speak, not as pleasing men, but God who tests our hearts. For neither at any time did we use flattering words, as you know, nor a cloak for covetousness, God is witness. Nor did we seek glory from men, neither from you or from others, when we might have made demands as apostles of Christ." Apparently, there were those who were enemies of the cross, enemies of the Apostle Paul and other preachers who were preaching the truth, who were trying to discredit them by saying that these preachers have just come and buttered you up. They've just flattered you, and that's the reason why you're following this doctrine. The Apostle Paul says, "We never used flattery. We are not looking for your approval. The only approval we want is from God. And because of that, we told you the truth, which sometimes meant we had to tell you that you were wrong, and sometimes meant we could encourage you when you're doing that which is right." Matter of fact, he uses two illustrations to try to help them understand his motivation in teaching them the truth, both negatively and positively. We pick up the reading here in verse 10. Well, no, first let's read verse 7, where he says, "But we were gentle among you, as a nursing mother cherishes her own children, so affectionately longing for you, we were well pleased to impart to you not only the gospel of God, but also our own lives, because you had become dear to us." The first illustration he uses is this of a mother. Now, a mother is someone who is going to tell her child positive things, things that are going to encourage them. But the mother is not going to flatter the child unless there are some real issues with her self-esteem, real issues with their relationship. She is going to be thinking about the best for the child. She's even going to be willing to give herself for the child. So she's going to tell the child positive things, complimenting things to encourage the good qualities, and she's going to be willing to tell that child negative things, things that they need to change so that that child can become better. The Apostle Paul says, that's the way I was in the use of my tongue. I was willing to tell you the good and the bad for your betterment. And I did not care about your approval. The only approval I cared for was God's. I was just looking out for your best interest. And he also uses, and now let's go to verse 10, a second illustration. He says, you are witnesses, and God also, how devoutly and justly and blamelessly we behaved ourselves among you who believe, as you know how we exhorted and comforted and charged every one of you as a father does his own children, that you would have a walk worthy of God who calls you into his own kingdom and glory. He says, I was like a father. I told you the truth. I told you the truth so that you might have a walk worthy of this calling, of this gospel that I have preached to you. There seems to be a trend among some parents where you only tell a child positive things. You only tell a child the good things. You tell them how beautiful they are. You tell them how wonderful they are. You tell them how smart they are, that they are the smartest kid in the world, that they are the most beautiful little girl in the world, that they are the strongest little boy. They are the best. They are the smartest. They are the greatest. Only tell them what is positive. But the problem with that flattering tongue is that even a young child can see that that can't possibly be true. There's got to be some other reason for only telling me these positive, wonderful things that are exaggerations of the truth. And unfortunately, then mom and or dad become discredited in everything that they say then. No, there needs to be a balance of telling the truth. Telling the truth in a way, sometimes the most positive thing that we can do is tell someone when they are wrong, so that they can make correction and we can encourage them to do what is right. The Apostle Paul was willing to do that. These brethren here in Galatia, they had been converted to Christ, and yet they had some false teachers that were coming and taking advantage of them, teaching them error. And so the Apostle Paul said in verse 16, have I therefore become your enemy because I tell you the truth? They zealously court you. These false teachers are looking for a line to pick you up. They zealously court you, but for no good. Yes, they want to exclude you, that you may be zealous for them. But it is good to be zealous in all thing in a good thing always, and not only when I am present with you. The Apostle Paul was willing to speak the truth, so that, as the wise writer said, a word fitly spoken is like apples of gold in the setting of silver. Like an earring of gold or an ornament of fine gold is a wise reprover to an obedient ear. The tongue can be so effective in helping people to become better people if the tongue speaks the truth. When you open your mouth and you let your tongue flap, what comes out? Bitter water or fresh? A third way, third contrast in the way that we might use our tongue, some might use it in a divisive way, whereas we should be using it in a way to be a peacemaker. Have you ever met someone like this? Someone who is always looking for a fight. Someone who is always looking to stir things up. Someone who's always looking to tear others apart. And it seems as though with some, there is some pleasure in bringing about division and bringing about a difficult relationships and bringing about a lack of resolution. Well, in the Old Testament, among the wise writings of Solomon, Solomon had this to say in the sixth chapter of the book of Proverbs and in verse 16 beginning. These six things the Lord hates. Yes, seven are an abomination to Him. And notice how many things have to do with the tongue. We're going to emphasize the last thing that he says, but as we go through this list here, a proud look, a lying tongue, hands that shed innocent blood, a heart that devises wicked plans, feet that are swift in running to evil, a false witness who speaks lies, and one who sows discord among brethren. How is it that you sow discord? Kind of has this the imagery of someone who is sowing seed. Well, the hoe that you use to till the ground is that tongue. And the seed that is sown on that tilled ground are the words that come from the tongue. And the fertilizer that helps that plant grow is what comes from the tongue. Sometimes individuals use their tongue to sow discord among brethren. And it says in verse 16 that God hates these things. These are an abomination unto God. If you find that when you open your mouth, that things come out where you're always looking for... You know, there are some families that are like that, aren't they? There are some families that are in constant turmoil. They're constantly fighting. They're constantly arguing about something. And there's no resolution to that fighting. And the kids grow up stressed. The kids grow up anxious because that's all that they've ever seen. And there's a very good chance that they are going to begin to use their tongue in that way as well, where they use their tongues in destructive ways. Even in a larger context than just the immediate family. You know, sometimes you have family reunions, and you know that if Aunt so-and-so or Cousin so-and-so is going to show up, there's going to be problems. There's going to be an argument. There's going to be a division. There's something's going to get stirred up because that's just how they use that tongue of theirs. Well, notice in this same chapter here, Proverbs chapter 6, starting with verse 12, the wise writer, he describes a particular individual, and he says in verse 12 that this individual is worthless. It's a very strong condemnation. This individual, a worthless person, a wicked man, walks with a perverse mouth. He winks with his eyes. He shuffles his feet. He points with his fingers. Perversity is in his heart. He devises evil continually. He sows discord. Same phrase as in the listing of things that God hates, yes, that are an abomination to Him. He sows discord. He finds ways that he pulls brethren apart. In verse 15, therefore, his calamity shall come suddenly. Suddenly, he shall be broken without remedy. There is going to be some recompense for that. You know, in the New Testament, there is an example of such an individual. In the book of 3 John, very short book, but a book written by John where he identifies a particular man who was using his tongue in a very destructive way, in a divisive way. In 3 John, beginning with verse 9, I wrote to the church, but Diotrephes, who loves to have the preeminence among them, does not receive us. Therefore, if we come, I will call to mind his deed which he does, prating against us with malicious words, and not content that he himself does not receive the brethren and forbids those who wish to, putting them out of the church. Behold, do not, my beloved, do not imitate what is evil, but what is good. He who does good is of God. He who does evil has not seen God. This Diotrephes was an individual in the church, John says, who loved to have the preeminence, and the way that was manifested was he was arguing against, he was prating against, he was using malicious words against John. Why would an individual do that? Well, it's sort of like first in 1 Corinthians, you had these divisions among the brethren. Why would teachers, why would they try to bring brethren to themselves? Why would they delight in these divisions? I think the primary reason is because of power. Because it shows that you have power when you can divide brethren. You see, if all you speak is the truth, if I speak the truth, if you speak the truth, if another speaks the truth, then we're in harmony and we're walking all together and the truth gets the glory. But if I want glory to myself, if I want to show that I am the one who has power, if I am strong-willed and bull-headed and opinionated and I want to make sure that I am having my ego stroked, then I teach something that is at variance to the truth. I teach my own opinions, and then people have to choose whether or not they're going to follow me or they're going to follow someone else's opinions about the truth. And then I know who I have. I think it's about power. I think it's about stroking the ego. And all that has to do with the works of the flesh, not the fruit of the Spirit. So listen to yourself as you talk through the day. And if you find yourself with a divisive tongue, saying things and doing things to stir up, if you look at the wake that's behind you and all you see is a bunch of swirls as opposed to some calm, then you need to look and examine the way that you're using your tongue and seeing whether or not you're really recognizing the danger that is there. We need to be peacemakers. As a matter of fact, in the Sermon on the Mount, Jesus, when he was going through the Beatitudes, the blessed is the individual if they have this particular quality. As he's going through that list in verse 9, he says, blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the sons of God. This is a quality that God has, and therefore should be a quality that we have. Jesus certainly came to this earth to die for our sins so that we might have peace with God. But at the same time, Jesus said, I came not to bring peace into this world, but a sword. You see, there are some things that divide, and there are some things that bring together. But the thing that really matters is the truth. We can all be harmonious in the truth. It's when we begin to go into opinions and when we go into error that division occurs that is negative and that is going to bring about disaster. In the book of Romans and also in Hebrews, we find this encouragement to use our tongue in this way, given to us in this way. In Romans chapter 12 and verse 18, Paul said, if it is possible, and this is a key phrase, as much as depends on you, live peaceably with all men. Now certainly it's not possible with everyone, but as much as depends on you. In other words, use your tongue in a way that's going to promote peace rather than destroy peace and harmony. In the book of Hebrews, also in the 12th chapter, and in verse 14, the Hebrew writer says, pursue peace with all men, holiness, without which no one can see the Lord. If we are peacemakers, we are called sons of God. If we do peacemaking activities, if we seek after that which is going to promote love and unity and harmony, we are going to find ourselves able to see God. Not emphasizing the insignificant and the petty, but looking always at the truth. As the wise writer said, a soft answer turns away wrath, but a harsh word stirs up anger. It's all in the way we use our tongue. How is your tongue, when you open your mouth, what comes out? Is it fresh water that is going to bring life to all those around? Or is it bitter water? Is it salty water? Now, there's also another psalm that says, a fool vents all his feelings, but a wise man holds them back. Again, there's the need to control our tongue. I don't know how many exotic animals there are in North Alabama, but I do know that there are thousands of dangerous tongues in North Alabama. And not speaking of North Alabama, right here in this assembly, there are a few hundred dangerous tongues. We can't trust them. We can never trust our tongue. We always have to be on guard. We always have to be evaluating what we're saying. We always have to be sure that we're using this tongue in a proper way. Before I close the lesson, I would like for us to say our meditation verse one more time. And I'd like for you to say this throughout the week, look at it throughout the week, and examine your use of the tongue. Let's say it together. But no man can tame the tongue. It is an unruly evil full of deadly poison. James 3, verse 8. If you're not a Christian in the audience this morning, we would encourage you to come to Christ. Come to Christ so that you might have the forgiveness of sins and might begin the process of maturity, part of which is learning how to use your tongue. If you're not a Christian, we'd encourage you to become one this morning. If you are one and have gone back to the world, we would encourage you as well to come back to the Lord while we stand and sing.